supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Nan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Greed. It's also known as covetousness, one of the seven deadly sins. That word also comes up in the Ten Commandments. It's about wanting something we don't have and perhaps wanting more than we really need. But look, let's be realistic. We all want more. Even the most generous want more money to give away. Wanting, after all, is in our hardwiring. It helps us get from A to B. It keeps us reaching and, in some respects, growing, which begs the question, was Gordon Gekko in the movie Wall Street right when he said greed is good? On the other hand, we know greed can gnaw at our hearts and leave us feeling empty and disconnected. These questions are important this time of year and at this point in our history when protesters around the globe have drawn attention to the inequity and disparity and lack of democracy in our economic system. So greed is our topic today. My guests are Drs. Tim Kesser and Polly Young Eisendrath. Tim Kesser is a professor and chair of psychology at Knox College in Illinois. He lectures extensively on topics of consumerism and materialism, and he's written The High Price of Consumerism. He joins us by phone from Illinois. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Polly Young Eisendrath teaches psychology at University of Vermont. She's a consultant in leadership development at Norwich University. She has written many, many books, and her most recent is called The Self-Esteem Trap, and she joins us by phone from Vermont. Polly, my dear friend, it's so nice to be with you. Do we have you? Polly.
So happy, yes.
Yeah. And, of course, we'd like to hear from you about topics of greed. Our number is 888-477-9499. That's 888-477-9499. I'd like to hear, there's no question about whether we all have it, but I'd like to hear how it affects you and what you do with it. 888-477-9499. Tim, let's start with you. Let's get our definition straight. How do we define greed?
Well, the way that I understand greed is it's materialism gone even more extreme. So it's a really strong concern with having money and possessions and the other things that go with that, which are oftentimes status and image. And, you know, everybody is fairly materialistic at one level or another. Of course, we vary a fair bit. But greed is when, I would say, that starts to really dominate our lives and starts to press out other kinds of aims we might have, including helping other people and sustaining the earth.
So greed is to materialism almost what social drinking is to problem drinking. It's when it begins to interfere with your life.
Well, we do know that materialism, short of greed, also does interfere with people's lives and with other people's lives as well. So materialism, as we'll probably talk about later, both affects our own well-being and other people's well-being. But greed would be an even more extreme form of that, sure.
Polly, you said when we spoke with you earlier that generosity is the opposite of greed. Is it really either or? Can't we have both?
Well, I think it's a contrast of greed, you know, that you could think of greed as something like holding on, kind of gripping something tightly, craving that kind of, you know, addictive response, we might say, wanting more than we need. Whereas generosity, it seems like, is more like opening your hand or your heart and sharing with others. They're not necessarily, I think, opposites in our behaviors, but they provide, I think, a real contrast in terms of the way we might feel about others or the world.
But we are both, yes? I don't want to make people feel guilty because they've got these strong desires.
Well, well, I wouldn't want people to feel guilty either about their desires. I think that everybody has desire and everybody wants things. I think as Tim was defining it, greed goes a little further than what we might call the normal wanting, needing, desire. You know, for me, I think of greed as something that comes along with self-protection. It's kind of wanting to pile up stuff for yourself. So for me, it's a little more extreme than desire.
Yeah, I want to talk about the symbolism of all that, you know, acquisition of stuff. Polly, where does envy fit in all of this?
Well, you know, I pretty much take the definition of envy from the psychoanalyst Melanie Klein, and she said it was a form of hatred. It's hating somebody or, you know, even sometimes something that has resources that you cannot have. And it expresses itself in terms, usually, of putting down other people, a sort of sour grapes. Occasionally, of course, there's a straight-out attack on others who have things that you can't have or get for yourself. And she contrasts it with jealousy, which is the desire to possess something else that you go after then and compete for. So she really makes this contrast between envy, which is kind of a hatred, and jealousy, which is competition. And I think those are useful ways of thinking about how we feel about stuff that other people have.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with psychologist Tim Kasser and Polly Young Eisendrath about greed, about stuff. We all want it. What's it mean? And why do we want it? Our number is 888-477-9499. Tim, some of your research, and you alluded to this earlier, demonstrates that materialistic values are in opposition of what you call pro-social values. Explain.
Yeah, well, that would go back to what we've heard already, that, you know, what we know is that in the human motivational system, some values are more or less compatible with each other, and they're fairly easy to pursue at the same time, and some values stand in relative conflict with each other. They're pretty hard to pursue at the same time. So, for example, with regard to materialism and the desire for money, what the research shows across numerous cultures, dozens of cultures, is that the desire for money is fairly compatible with the desire for status and the desire for image, because mostly how you get status and image in our cultures and other cultures is through material financial means. But at the same time, the desire for money and possessions and status stand in relative opposition to the more pro-social values, what we sometimes call the community feeling values or others call the universalism values. And the research across, again, dozens of nations show that it's relatively difficult to simultaneously pursue those two different sets of values, but we do have both of them. It's just that as you turn one on, you tend to turn the other off. There's some really fascinating experimental studies that have shown that, that once you turn on the idea of money, it actually decreases how pro-social people behave.
It's interesting. Polly, we got a caller just called and wondered, when children argue about the inheritance after a parent died, is that greed or is that the same thing as entitlement?
Well, I think, you know, it depends on the, it's a case-by-case basis, obviously. But I think that the competition, envy, jealousy thing comes in very often with siblings. And the thing that's kind of amazing to me is that it doesn't matter if the siblings are toddlers or if they're in their 70s or their 80s. Right. They can still have that feeling that someone else got more than I got, and it's not fair. So, you know, it's my sense is that probably inheritance and siblings is more jealousy, envy than greed. Although, you know, greed can enter in. I'm sure if there's a lot of money involved.
I wonder if it's a feeling that I don't have enough. I don't have enough money. I didn't have enough love from my parents. I don't have enough. There's something missing inside of me that produces that sense of desire and greed that, you know, if we felt comfortable with ourselves, you wouldn't be there.
Well, how many people feel really comfortable with themselves, Dan? What do you think about that? You know, is it...
Seven? I'm guessing seven. Just
right.
A ballpark.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's there are so many of us don't have any measure of what enough is, and maybe Tim has research on that. But you know, of course, in psychotherapy, people say I don't have enough time, I don't have enough money, I don't get enough love. Well, but they've never actually thought about what the sort of marking point would be for enough.
Yeah. Tim, we devote all this energy to acquiring stuff, and we're not looking for stuff per se. We're probably looking for security and well-being. And it seems that the stuff flies in the face of security and well-being.
Well, I would agree that lots of times when we're feeling psychologically insecure, we do orient towards stuff as a way to kind of cope, or at least try to cope. It's not necessarily the best coping mechanism, but it is something that people do try. And again, the research does bear that out with a variety of different kinds of studies. You know, I do think that people orient towards, you know, possessions and money for all different kinds of reasons. Sometimes it's to show that they're competent. Sometimes it's to try to get a sense of love. Sometimes it's a sense of status. Sometimes it's following all those marketing messages that tell us over and over that we will be happy if we get this and that possession. Again, what the research shows, though, is that the more people focus on those kinds of values, it's actually the case that they're less happy, and it interferes with their relationships and oftentimes interferes with their sense of self-esteem.
Polly, in this culture, do we consciously or unconsciously teach our children to be greedy?
Well, you know, in the book that I did and that came out in 2008, The Self-Esteem Trap, it was really focusing on the problem that parents have right now in, I think, over-focusing on their children and on their children's needs. And here I'm talking really about middle class and upper middle class parents who actually often create an environment in which children expect to have their needs served first and to be the focus of attention. And I think that has created now a couple of cohorts of young adults who have real difficulty coming into the world, coming in at the lower levels of the hierarchy, coming into an environment that does not provide them with what they want and doesn't actually meet their needs for self-importance. So, you know, I have been afraid that we baby boomers started something that the next generation of parents has carried forward, which is that we tried to inject self-esteem into our children by telling them how great they are and then more or less saying to them, and this was an honest mistake, I made it too, you know, you can do anything you want. You can be anything you want. You just get it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, that kind of creates a hungry attitude towards getting stuff for yourself, I think.
Hmm. Yeah, I remember a session many years ago with a gentleman who was a recovering alcoholic, and he said, I know I can be anything I want to be. And I said, no, you can't. You just can't. You don't have an IQ of 250, and you don't have resources, and you're not the most creative human in the world. You can't. I mean, it's like Tim talks about these pro-social values. So, these big pronouns, you can be anything you want to be, kind of is the opposite of pro-social values. But I want to talk about the other side of this. And Tim, we'll start with you. You and Polly both look at our form of capitalism as one that encourages materialism and maybe even greed.
Mm-hmm.
But 70% of our GDP depends on consumer spending. So, if we made that shift to, more pro-social values, I mean, my God, our economy is already pretty fragile. So what's the balance here?
Well, my sense is that there are a variety of other costs to our economy as well, including the kind of inequality that was described before. We know that as this economy has been expanding, inequality has actually gone up over the last 40 years. We also know that our particular economic structure is associated with less pro-social values, less equality, actually with less freedom of certain sorts, as well as pretty massive ecological disaster. And so I think one of the things we have to be asking ourselves is whether or not we have created an economic structure, a political structure, and a social structure which is actually doing a pretty good job of meeting people's needs. It's doing a great job of putting things into the mall and the shopping centers and onto the internet to buy. But economies are there in order to help people have a high quality of life and future generations have a high quality of life. And in that respect, our form of capitalism, I think, fails in most respects. And so those are the kinds of questions that I would be raising, and I hope our politicians would start to raise.
Well, let's put a little more meat on those bones there, as long as we're talking about the economy and
sure.
And pro-social values. There was a study done at University of Jerusalem where Professor Shalom Schwartz looked at capitalism across 70 nations. So what did he find? What worked best? What didn't work?
Well, I think that study is actually in 20 nations, if memory serves. But what he looked at was different varieties of capitalism. So the idea is that just like there are different varieties of Christianity, there's Protestantism and Catholicism, et cetera, there are different forms of capitalism. And the economists Hall and Gingrich talk about two main kinds. There are the more highly competitive neoliberal forms of capitalism, like we have in the U.S. or in the U.K. and Ireland. And there are more what are called the strategic or coordinated forms of capitalism, which are kind of things like you see in the Scandinavian social democratic countries, et cetera. And what Schwartz found, and what I've since replicated, by the way, with another measure of economic deregulation, is that the extent to which a nation is highly focused on the neoliberal, super-competitive, free-market way of organizing a capitalist economy, the more the citizens of that nation focus on things like money and status and image, and actually the less that they focus on values that are pro-social, values that involve equality, values that involve protecting the environment, and also the less they end up focusing on values that have to do with their own intellectual freedom and curiosity and the rest, because those values stand in opposition. So the value speaking, at least, the more successful forms of capitalism are less deregulated, more kind of cooperative, less focused on maximizing economic growth at all costs.
Mm. We've got to take a short break. When we come back, I want to ask you, Tim. You know, you laid out a wonderful argument. So could you tell us in two or three steps how we're going to change this economy? So we're going to take a 60-second break. You'll have a minute to think about that. We're talking about greed and materialism and how it sits often in contradiction with what we're calling pro-social things like generosity and compassion. My guests are Tim Kesser and Polly Young Eisendrath. Tim Kesser is a professor, chair of psychology at Knox College. He's written The High Price of Consumerism. Polly Young Eisendrath teaches psychology at the University of Vermont, and she has written The Self-Esteem Trap. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents Art After Five, a blend of jazz and international entertainment every Friday. This Friday, Toyland with Drew Nugent and the Midnight Society, featuring jazz and dance music from the golden 1920s and 30s. The holiday feast for the ears turns into a visual display as tap dancing dolls spring to life in Toyland, beginning at 5:45. More details are available at philamuseum.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails. He co-wrote the music for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Last year, he won an Oscar for the score for The Social Network. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
That was ABBA. That was not my family Thanksgiving dinner. That was ABBA singing. My guests are Tim Kesser and Polly Young Eisendrath. We are talking about greed. Well, we're talking about materialism and our economy and how what we do often interferes with our sense of happiness and well-being. Before our break, Tim Kesser was talking about our economy and this form of capitalism interfering with people's well-being and pro-social values. Tim, I told you I'd give you 60 seconds to think about how to fix it. So,
well, you know, there's two questions, actually. I'm just going to note. The first question is, what would the alternative look like? And then the second question is, how do we get from where we are to that alternative? And I'd like to make a distinction between those two. So let's talk first about what the alternative is. The alternative involves having an economic organization that is less focused on enhancing materialism and consumerism at pretty much every turn in order to maximize the economy and the economic growth. Now, I've written about the dozens of ways that we need to make changes in that respect. So, for example, I don't have time to talk about them all unless you want me to.
No, scare me.
Yeah, but just a couple things. So, for example, right now, advertising is actually a tax write-off. I don't know if listeners know that, but all the $100-some billion that were spent on advertising last year was a tax write-off instead of being taxed. That sends a pretty clear message about what's important. That's one change we could make. Another kind of change we could be making would be to ban advertising to children. We know that advertising to children is particularly problematic for various aspects of their health.
Go
ahead.
All of this is wonderful, but how do we get there?
The difficulty of getting there is that we have an economic and a media system which, on the whole, other than wonderful outlets like your own, make it extremely difficult to talk about these things, because since the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, we have basically a government structure that is even more influenced by for-profit corporations. And the fact of the matter is that five corporations own about 95% of the media airwaves, making it very difficult to have a serious conversation about the problems of our economy, because they're highly invested in keeping it the way that it is so that they can maximize profit for their shareholders. Mm. So, you know, until we fix those two things, until we fix the way that the government is financed and elections are financed, and until we fix and have truly a free media instead of a corporate-sponsored media, then it's going to be very difficult to have serious debate about these issues.
I'm not so sure anybody's got a great taste for that, although I really do appreciate your comments about public radio and public broadcasting. And I'm going to see if we can fly you out here for our next fundraiser. let's go to the phones. We've had a lot of people holding on now. We've got Mike on the line. Hi, Mike. Mike?
Hi, Dan.
Yeah.
First of all, I'd like to congratulate you on the timeliness of your program today. Obviously, you must have made a recent trip to one of our local malls to see about greed. I'd also like to compliment Polly on her fantastic book, The Self-Esteem Trap. Wonderful reading. Finally, somebody addresses the fact that we're trying to make all of our children think they're the center of the universe, which is not true. I'm a single father of an 8-year-old daughter, and believe me, we are anything but materialistic in my household. In fact, my daughter wants nothing for Christmas, she told me. So, anyhow, that out of the way, I'd like to also address one thing. You know, we spend so much time in this society focusing on peer pressure of children, therapies, how we resolve these issues. We should spend that much time and attention addressing adult peer pressure and why, if my neighbor has a brand new SUV, I feel like I need to have one. You touched on it earlier, Dan. Therapy session, re-education, perhaps something, I don't know. I just want to make that comment. What do you think we could do to start re-educating adult mentality?
Yeah,
I'll take the answer to that.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for your comment and your question, and congratulations on having a daughter like the one you have. She sounds terrific. So let's. I'd like to hear both you react to Mike's question, Polly.
Well, thanks for the plug for my book. Thanks for that. You know, the thing that I was thinking about when Tim was talking is that so much has to change in our worldview, in the way we look at life, in order for us to change the system in which we live. I live very close to Canada here, and I find that the Canadians actually have more sort of a natural sense of generosity, sharing, good manners, so what I would call just a kind of civil way of living, than typically I find in America. Now, Vermont is also a bit different, but where I want to kind of connect this is to parenting. You know, in order to change the mindset of people growing up, we have to change the way we actually act as parents, and that has been so painful. While I can talk to young people who grow up in environments that were overly child-centered, and they understand what has to change, once they go into parenting, there's a kind of narcissistic pleasure in making your child the center of attention. And it is very, very hard to let that go. So, you know...
In your book, The Self-Esteem Trap, you talked about how to teach children to be compassionate. So how was that done?
Well, you know, one thing is actually to help your child focus on what's going on in the larger environment of the family or the immediate moment. That is, there are always needs, there are always ways to help, and even with a very young child, there's a way to either focus towards everything that child is doing or towards the general environment in which the child is existing. You know, I can't go into a lot of details here, but I would say sharing, collaborating, and focusing on others, that's key. And here's one that I very often mention to parents: stop boasting about your kids. And that actually takes a bit of discipline. I mean, I want to boast about my grandchildren, but I actually do discipline myself because I recognize that when I'm with other people, they do not want to know the details of every tiny thing that my, you know, favorite at the moment grandchild is doing. And it's a way also of talking about myself without saying so. So, you know, there's some very immediate things that people can do to reduce this sense that somehow my child is absolutely wonderful, incredible, the most gifted, the most generous, the fastest, the wisest,
well,
whatever.
And Polly, that even works with grandchildren. I want to argue because I like bragging about Sam, and frankly, I don't give a damn if people are interested or not. They're going to hear about him.
Well, I'll make an exception for you, Dan.
Thank you. You're so good to me. But on a serious note, getting back to teaching compassion, isn't it really all about role modeling? I mean, a friend of mine is taking her 3-year-old. They went out and they bought a gift, and now they're taking it to a homeless shelter. And she said to me, he really doesn't get it. Does he? That, you know, these children don't have parents or homes? And I said, no, at some level he does not get it. But do that. Do that a few times a year, and he will absorb it before he gets it. So I see it as being 90% role modeling.
Well, there are many levels of this, you know, and I've always struck by the Dalai Lama saying that in Tibet, children on their birthdays make gifts for all the people
mothers,
in their families,
yeah.
For their families, because they've been given the gift of life. So, you know, it's like we have to shift our perspective, and in order to change parenting, and in order, I think, to change the structure of our culture, we have to change our conversations. As Tim pointed out, we have to actually include these kinds of conversations in our media, and we have to raise serious questions about what we're doing, because in promoting a culture of greed, which I really do think we are doing, and that's what our economy is based on, it's a kind of greedy consumption, we're also promoting unhappiness. We're promoting the less satisfying things in life, and lots of research shows that. So, you know, we have to, at this point, start new conversations and ask ourselves some very serious questions. We're in pretty bad shape here,
yeah,
in North America. In America, you know, I mean, I think Canada's doing a little better, actually, in certain ways.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Kellen on the line. Hi, Kellen.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment was that my husband and I are both school teachers, and I have 2 children. And I'm a work in progress, but my goal over the years has been to give my children experiences and skills and move away just from giving them things, because I've noticed in my classroom and at home that the children are happier when they can say, I can do it, versus I have it. I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Kellen, I want to tell you a story, and if my memory was longer than about 20 minutes... I might have told this story last week, but it was about a visit to the Boys and Girls Club of Camden. And I met a young boy. It's in an awful neighborhood. It's in a neighborhood where someone had been killed the night before with an AK-47. I asked this boy what he wanted for Christmas. He wanted to be with his parents. That's all he wanted was to be with his parents. Tim, I'd like to hear you react to Kellen's comment.
Yeah, well, I do think that she's kidding in on what kids really do need.
Right.
You know, what they do need is a chance to expand and test their own skills and see what it is that they can learn. And, you know, they're only going to learn so much from the average toy, you know, plastic toy that you pick up at the big box store. You know, there's far better kinds of experiences and opportunities that we can give children. I myself, since my kids have been about age 2, I don't give them any birthday presents ever. I give them a special day with Dad, we call it, and we figure out what fun thing we want to do, and I take the day off of work and we go do that. And obviously it's changed over the years as they've grown from 2 until 14 years, but my sense is, you know, what I'm really giving them is my time, my attention, my energy, and something fun to do. And I have the feeling that lasts longer than just another toy.
Yeah, you're giving them your presence.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Polly?
Well, I would completely agree with everything that when Kellen called in, I thought she put it so succinctly also, and Tim is too, that
in order to increase our sense of autonomy in life, and by autonomy I mean self-determination, that we can get around in the world, that we can take ourselves places and do what we need to do, we have to have skills. We have to engage in actual experience. And, you know, I don't even know if it's so much these days the toys, it's the social media that seem to me to interfere starting at a very, very young age, the cell phone, the tweeting, the Facebook, and I worry more about that than probably any other influence on our kids, other than parents, over-focusing on their children. But I think social media is one of those parts of our culture that has come into being for commercial reasons, and so many young people actually feel that they need to show what they do on Facebook in order for it to be real. My kids are older. They're on Facebook a lot. My college students are on Facebook a lot. I just worry about that way of relating. It's not direct. It's not action-oriented.
Yeah. Tim, before we take our break, could you tell us a little bit about your lifestyle?
My own personal lifestyle?
Yeah.
I teach at a small liberal arts college that's been very supportive of what I want to do, and also has allowed me to teach at a reduced level for a reduced pay so that I can pursue other kinds of interests, including activism. My wife also works part-time. We were extremely careful to buy a house we could afford on just one salary, and we've got 10 acres of land where we grow some of our own food, and we've got, you know, chickens for eggs. We're vegetarian. We have no internet in the house. TV has always been extremely limited in our house for our children. I've never owned a cell phone and hope never to. Never been on Facebook, hope never to. So that's a quick summary, I guess.
So I'm thinking, Tim, maybe you're one of those seven people I talked about in the beginning of the show who are comfortable with everything they have inside.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
You sound like you could be in the top 10 anyway. we have to take a break, and we've got lots more callers who want to join the conversation. We are talking about greed and materialism, and when we come back, I want to talk about what we can do on an individual level to counter it. Polly Young-Eisendrath teaches psychology at the University of Vermont. She's written several books. Her most recent is The Self-Esteem Trap. Tim Kasser is a professor and chair of psychology at Knox College in Illinois, and he's written The High Price of Consumerism. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY. FM.
A troubled young woman suffers a tragic loss, yet also finds her way to a new, rewarding life.
And an insecure schoolboy finds new confidence through his own deepest convictions. I'm Murray Horwitz.
And I'm Susan Stamberg. Hear those stories and more on the 2011 edition of Hanukkah Lights from NPR.
Tomorrow night at 10 on WHYY.
At this time of year, mail comes pouring out of the post office, but during the rest of the year, USPS faces mounting debt. We'll look at how people who rely on the service are being affected now and what future cutbacks could mean for them. Democratic Representative Ed Towns is with us to explain what Congress is doing to save the Postal Service. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
You're a vile one, Mr. Grinch. You have termites in your smile. You have all the tender sweetness of a seasick crocodile, Mr. Grinch.
Mr. Grinch, whose heart was three sizes too small until the end, when his heart grows. And that's what we're shooting for today on Voices in the Family. How's that for a segue? My guests are Tim Kasser and Polly Young-Eisendrath. Tim, before we took our break, you talked about your lifestyle, no internet in your home, a relatively modest lifestyle so that you can do what you feel passionate about. Do you get much pressure to change, internal or external?
No, I mean, there are people who think what I do and how I live my life is kind of odd sometimes, but I wouldn't say very often I get that sense of pressure. My own pressure is sort of more internal in some respects that, you know, like everybody, I've lived in this culture, you know, and grown up in it, or everybody in this culture, I guess I'm like them, you know, and I have some of those same desires that sometimes I have to put in check and say, no, you know, I don't need to work anymore right now, you know, just go take a walk or play the piano or hang out with my family. So I would say my pressures are internal, but I've also really tried to make sure that I'm not exposed to a lot of the things in the environment which are the reminders to, you know, go by and work hard and all of the rest. I've sort of tried to extract myself from that so I don't have those kinds of pressures impinging upon me nearly as much as I think the average American seems to.
So one of the things I'm hearing and one of the things I suggest to everyone is that the process of change really doesn't happen unless there is heartfelt devotion. And that's what I hear as you talk, Tim. There's a kind of devotion to this lifestyle, to these values.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think that's wrong, but I also guess I don't think of it that way. I think I'm doing what seems to me to make the most sense for my life and my family's life and for my happiness and for the world. You know, it's just what makes most sense to me. So I think that's how I think of it.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Meg on the line. Hi, Meg.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. You?
Good, good. My question is about addiction. We're talking about greed as choice. I have a son who, at 6, when he checked out his product at Toys R Us, would start crying because he didn't like what he had. And now at 14, he will, as soon as he gets new Jordans that he's been asking for a month, he turns around, goes online, and wants the next pair. He also will eat one cookie. He can't eat one cookie, eats the whole box. So I see addiction here, not choice, or not totally choice.
Yeah. It does sound like there might be some compulsive behavior. Polly, your thoughts?
Well, you know, it's hard to address, again, a particular case, but in general, I would say that we probably face our kids with too many choices too soon. You know, I have Japanese friends who grew up in an environment where nobody ever asked, you know, would you like a juice or milk? You know, they were presented with milk or they were presented with juice. And that creates, I think, a little more settledness if you feel that you're always really on the edge because you have to choose the right thing. Then I think very quickly, once you've chosen something, you see the flaws in it.
Yeah,
and this is part of the irony of, you know, of being able to choose, you know, from among many things to have something of one's own.
There's lots of research about choice raising anxieties. Peter Weibrow out at UCLA wrote a book called The Tyranny of Choice. But I would wonder, Meg, what happens to you when your son has these kinds of reactions? What goes on inside of you, and what do you do about it? I guess we lost Meg. Yeah, we lost Meg. But I think, you know, it's an important question, is what happens to mom? What does mom do, or a parent do, to reinforce that behavior or to help extinguish it? And, when I hear a child that's engaging in these kinds of behaviors, you know, as a clinical therapist, you know, I want to meet with the parents first.
Yeah, it's always hard to say specifically, but, you know, there, what you talked about, Dan, in terms of anxiety, I think a parent feels anxiety also when the parent sees so much immediate unhappiness in a child. And you know, I think the problem is, again, this sense that we can have what we want and we should be able to get it and get it quickly. And then, you know, what we actually have, we see the flaws in so quickly. So partly it really, this whole shift that we're talking about needing to make as a culture is really based on shifting our frame of reference. And, you know, shifting our perspective on things. And I think for parents, it has to happen usually kind of slowly, and the parents have to see the merit, and they also have to have some community that supports them.
That's right.
You know, if you really need other people to talk to in order to live the way Tim does, you know. He has, I'm sure, others who also agree that it's a good thing. I have a very large Buddhist community that I relate to here. But if I didn't, some of the things that I do would seem to be crazy to other people.
Yeah, we do need to expand the system, and we do need to find where we really belong. I wonder, you know, Meg alluded to the addiction question, and I wonder about spending addiction or hoarding, and those I have treated with both of those things seem to be selfless, that there's not a whole lot of core inside. And I wonder if that's part of the issue. Is this quantitatively different from greed, or is it the same thing? Tim?
Well, I think issues of compulsive consumption, from what I know of that, are related to greed, but I do think that there is this sense of I can never be satisfied, but it's less that I want more and more in a sort of a Donald Trump, Gordon Gekko kind of way, as it is. I can't stop myself from, you know, seeing this next new thing that I might have, because this last thing hasn't filled up the hole that I hoped it would fill up. Mm-hmm. So I do think that there is probably a distinction to be made there from the greed, and I don't know that it quite interferes with the pro-social behavior in exactly the same way that some of these other types of behaviors do.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard, by the way, rumors that compulsive consumption might make the next edition of the American Psychiatric Association Manual on Diagnostic Disorders, which I think would be a wonderful step forward, because thus far it's not in there.
I do, too. We've got a caller, Polly, who wants to know about the genetics. She said that her sister and her mother are both greedy.
Well, I'm sorry for her. I, you know, it's hard to say. I think also, you know, here's one of my sort of, I don't know, a bees in my bonnet or whatever. You know, I think we talk about genetics a little too quickly. I actually think the social environment influences a great deal. And, you know, a mother and a sister are probably at least they grow up in the same social environment. You know, I think we're more on to what I would consider to be the core of the issue in talking about anxiety and in talking also about how one feels about oneself in relation to things. So, you know, I wouldn't think in terms of genetics so much, but rather the same social environment.
Mm. Well,
if I could just jump in real quick, I've only ever seen one study that has looked at genetic effects on materialism, and to my surprise, it found zero effect of genetics, that it was all actually environment. Some was shared and some was non-shared environment, but no effect of genetics in that twin study, which really surprised me. It was that low.
Question asked and answered then. Polly, you're pretty clear about what's important in our pursuit of well-being and happiness, and you said it's about love. Well, I wonder if this is about science, or is this an ex-hippie living in Vermont breathing that kind of weird Vermont air up there?
Well, let me say that I think it's about reality. I think that love, and by love what I mean is our ability to really hold another person in mind and to be a witness, You know, that there is something very specific that all of us need, and we recognize it when we get it. We recognize it ourselves when someone holds us in mind, pays attention to us, is a witness to our lives, and helps us see ourselves. And to me, that's at the core of life. I think as human beings, we depend on looking into someone else's eyes to see ourselves, and that's a kind of circular process that goes on, if it does go on, again and again and again through the entire lifespan. And it is really what feeds us. I don't think there's any substitute for it. And until we can have that in our lives, we tend to use these other things to try to fill in. And I think also that learning how to love is a skill. I think it's based on actually being with other people who do it well. And, you know, many of us have had gaps in our growing up, but we can make up for them as adults, and we can also build compassion and kindness, which are related to love, but not quite the same thing.
In my experience, anxiety and insecurity interfere with that kind of altruistic, compassionate love, and that altruistic, compassionate love also cures anxiety and insecurity. So I encourage our listeners to try that altruism. The great 20th century philosopher Bruce Springsteen once said, "Everybody has a hungry heart. It's a question of what we do with it and how we manage it." Well, I've been talking about greed today with Tim Kasser and Polly Young Eisendrath. I want to thank both of you so much for joining us today. Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll re-air our interview with Rachel Simon, author of Story of Beautiful Girl. You can email us at voices@whyy.org. You can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. I want to stop reading and just listen, but I'll go on. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteers. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy the music, my friends.